Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today it's Sir Tim Rice with A Personal History of Musicals.
Thank you all for coming. It's a great honour to be here. And Broadchalk, I only really know through playing cricket here, but it's obviously a hotbed of literary passion and genius, and I'm very proud to be a minor part of it. Can you hear me at the back? Do you want to hear me at the back? Can you hear me at the front? Yes, good. It's often difficult to judge. Really, I gave that title as a bit of a joke, really, to the wonderful authorities. And it's really in response to a question I'm often asked. People write to me and say, how do you get started in the business of either the music business, which I now don't understand at all, or how do you get going in the theatre, which I barely understand now. But I think it's quite interesting to tell my own little story of how I got caught up in the world of musical theatre. And it really just shows that there are no rules, and possibly that you just need to keep going. I was to take you back to 1962, when I was at a minor public school on the south coast of England. And it was moderately posh, obviously not as posh as you lot are, but it was really fairly good school, very conventional. And it happened to produce, when I was there, quite a few people who wound up in the theatre. I was an exact contemporary of Christopher Hampson and David Hare, who were both there with me. Although at the time, I don't think any of us quite knew what we were going to do. I certainly didn't. I had a pop group called the Aardvarks, who played at concerts in the school and school dances. And this was pre-Beatles, remember. It's a long time ago. And I was sort of the Cliff Richard of the group, and my mates were the Shadows. And Cliff and the Shadows were top dogs in those days. And I kind of would have quite liked to have had a go at being a pop star, but I sort of felt, being a very smart, respectable, middle-class lad, that I shouldn't do that, and I went into the law, which was a fatal mistake. And I failed my legal exams 3 times. While I was doing that, very unsuccessfully, I was writing songs because I still had harbored this sort of vague ambition to be a pop singer. And it seemed to me at that time that everybody I knew, including a lot of fairly posh chaps, were getting into the charts. Peter and Gordon were having hits, and it was the Donovan came from my hometown, the Zombies, I was at school with one or two of those. And it seemed to me that perhaps being in the music business was something I should have considered earlier and perhaps considered seriously. So I made a little tape of my voice singing. And I didn't want to sing anybody else's songs because, frankly, I didn't want to be compared to the people who sang the songs in the first place. I didn't want to sing a Tom Jones song or a Mick Jagger song or even a Bob Dylan song because it wouldn't have been as good as their interpretation. So I wrote 3 songs of my own, words and music. And I sent my tape, and this was pre-cassettes, the reel-to-reel tapes, and I sent my little tape round to several record companies. There were really only 4 record companies in the mid-60s in England, EMI, Philips, Decca, and Pi. And I sent my tape to all these companies and to 1 or 2 minor companies as well. And I got virtually no response until 2 or 3 months later in my lawyer's office, I got a call from a music publisher. Now, music publishers, as I'm sure you know, they're the guys who run these songs, who look after the songs, the copyright, rather than the actual recordings. Very much the business in those days was divided into those who made the records and sang on them and those who provided the songs. Obviously, a lot of people did both, but the business end of it was music publishers, record producers, record companies. And this was a music publisher to whom I'd not sent my tape. And this music publisher rang up and said, is that Tim Rice? And I said, yes. And he said, well, who wrote the songs? Because there's a very bad singer on this tape. But we do like one of the songs, and it's going to be recorded by one of our groups. And I said, well, actually, I wrote the songs, and I don't know what happened to the singer, but I certainly won't book him again. And I was very excited by this, and I thought, you know, there are quite a few bands around who might be looking for good songs. The Kinks, The Animals, Manfred Mann, Herman's Hermits, The Hollies, maybe the Beatles or the Rolling Stones have dried up and need a decent song. And it was revealed to me that it was going to be a group called The Night Shift. Now, The Night Shift, sad to say, have not made a great contribution to 20th century culture. And I think the reason was their career was my song. But it was still, I was kind of having a song recorded by a group and issued on a record label, a real live label. It was on the Pi label. And Pi were a big company. They began getting big way back with Lonnie Donegan, and they had the Searchers, and they had Petula Clark. They were a proper record company. And I was excited because I got my 45 RPM disc, which I don't know if any of you remember those things, black jobs with a hole in the middle. You put the needle on. And this record had my name under the night shift, had my song, which was called That's My Story. And underneath That's My Story, in tiny print, in brackets, it said T. Rice. Then underneath that, in bigger print, it said The Night Shift. And the record was okay. It wasn't great, and it wasn't the way I'd written it. I'd written it as a kind of Donovan-ish folk song. And they'd done it a bit like a sort of, you know, beat number, but it was okay. But I actually had a foot on the ladder. I had a record out. I mean, these days, anybody in this room here, in this tent, could make an album, a beautiful album, CD packaging, looking great. And you could then flog it at gigs and things. But there would be no, it might not be any good. It might be, but in those days, you had to have somebody else like your work to get a record out. Nowadays, most people can make a CD, certainly kids can. They can make a CD in their front room or in a very small recording studio. Back in 1965, very few people had a record pressing plant in their front room. So the fact that I had my name on a 45 RPM record, even though the record flopped and the night shift disappeared, it was still a mini achievement. And I was still in the law, failing my exams. And the record by the night shift came out and I'm afraid didn't do very much. And I was looking at the time, I was 19, 20, I was looking for any way to make a mark vaguely creatively. And I had an idea for a book, which I took to a book publisher. My mother was a freelance writer and she knew quite a few book publishers. And I went along to see this chap with my book, a guy called Desmond Elliott, who became a very successful publisher. He had, among others, in his, he had Jilly Cooper starting out, Leslie Thomas, and several cookbooks that sold millions. And he was a very successful book publisher. And I took along my idea for a book, which was basically a history of the record charts. And this I did eventually do many years later with my brother and Paul Gambaccini, which became the Guinness Book of Hit Singles. Because I was convinced then that people like lists, and people would buy anything that was a list, even if they weren't that interested in the product. And a lot of people are interested in the charts. But Desmond Elliott said, no, 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 I can't sell books about Mick Jagger's, you know, eyes or what he eats for breakfast, so I certainly can't sell this, just a list of facts. Well, he was wrong on that, but I thought he was right because I was only 19 and I respected my elders. And he said, what else do you do? And I said, well, I've written a song. And I gave him my record and he put it on and he said, no, I don't like that either. But he said, I know a young man called Andrew Lloyd Webber who is writing music and he's looking for someone to write words because his words man has just departed. Not from, you know, the world, but it just, he'd left school. And I thought, well, the name like that, Andrew Lloyd Webber, he'll have to change his name if he wants to make it. But I'd like to meet him. And Desmond said, Andrew's really more interested in the musical theater rather than, you know, the pop scene, which was what I was interested in. Anyway, I went along, I wrote a letter to Andrew. No email, no texts, no phones, anything. I wrote him a letter. And he rang me up at my lawyer's office, and I went round to see him in his parents' flat. And he said, hi, I'm Andrew, great to see you. Listen, I've written 8 musicals. He was 17. He said, I've written 8 musicals. Let me play you something. And he sat down at the piano, and I thought, this guy's good. And he had written about 8 musicals, most of which he'd done at school. He was at Westminster. And his partner, who'd written some songs with him, and particularly one musical based on the life of Dr. Bernardo, his partner, Robin Barrow, had just left the school a year ahead of Andrew and said he was going to do something much more sensible and be a doctor and really couldn't go on writing. And Andrew said, I need someone desperately to write this musical. Do you know anything about musical theater? Well, I didn't really. I'd only seen 2 musicals in my life at that point. One was Salad Days, which I saw when I was about 10. And the other was My Fair Lady, which is still my favorite musical of all time. And I had, however, heard many of my parents' albums. They had all the great show albums, all the Rodgers and Hammerstein, Carousel, South Pacific, Oklahoma, King and I. They had West Side Story. They had Lerner and Lowe. They had Cole Porter, Too Darn Hot, you know, Kiss Me, Kate. They had all these albums. And I loved those albums. And much as I used to play mainly Elvis, Buddy Holly, and the Everly Brothers, I also played their albums. And I particularly enjoyed the funny songs and the words. And I had, strangely, I was a bit weird, was, is, am. I had no real desire to go and see the shows, even though I knew the scores. But I did know and absolutely loved the songs. And so I had a working knowledge of the score of musical theater. And Andrew said, I'm writing this musical on Dr. Bernardo. He was the, as you all know, I'm sure, the Victorian philanthropist. And Andrew played me the tunes, and they were pretty good. And I said, well, I'll give it a go. And I skived off work for a couple of days in my lawyer's office and wrote about 5 or 6 lyrics for Andrew's tunes. And I wish I could do that at that speed today. And, you know, Andrew thought they were terrific. First one I wrote, the first couplet I ever wrote for Andrew was from an auction song in The Likes of Us, which began, here I have a lovely parrot sound in wind and limb. I can guarantee that there is nothing wrong with him. That's not quite Cole Porter, but it was good enough for Andrew at the time, and probably now. Anyway, we got on like a house on fire, and I was 19, he was 17, and Andrew I think knew he was going to make it. He was very determined. I was thinking, well, this guy is really talented. He's a nice guy. I'm enjoying myself with him, but obviously I'm going to have to get a proper job. And equally, obviously, law was not for me. So I managed to get myself a job as a management trainee at EMI Records. And in those days, I joined EMI on the 6th of the 6th in 1966. And EMI at that time had on their record sleeves the greatest recording organization in the world, and they were. They had the Beatles, so that was enough. But they had so many other huge acts, and EMI House in Manchester Square was the place to be. And I was as low down the pecking order as you could get, but I was in the middle of the swinging 60s. I was at the company that made Beatles records, and Cliff Richard records, and Shadows records, and Holly's records, and Herman's Hermits records, and Frank Sinatra records, and Dean Martin, and all the Tamla Motown, and a lot of classical stuff. It was the great place to be. And I was right at the bottom. I was what was called a management trainee, which means that in about 50 years' time, you might end up running EMI in Mexico City or something, if you're lucky. But I was in the A&R department, which is artists and repertoire, where they make the records. And I actually went to quite good record sessions. I went to Cliff Richard record sessions, where I literally made the coffee and set up the music stands. And I worked for a great record producer called Norrie Paramore. And so I was beginning to get a foot on the ladder of the actual music business, the proper music business. And in the evenings, I was writing songs with Andrew, who was a student at the Royal College of Music. And we were trying to make it together as songwriters. And The Likes of Us was the name of our Dr. Bernardo show. And Desmond Elliott, the publisher, thought it was jolly good. And he made every effort to get this on in the West End. Now, there were two problems. One, Desmond was a brilliant book publisher. But not, to be honest, he didn't really have all the nous about the theater that was needed. And secondly, the show wasn't quite good enough. It was very derivative. It was very like Oliver Light. Oliver, the brilliant, brilliant musical by Lionel Bart, which every time I hear it, I mean, at the time, probably 1967, I thought, well, it's okay. Now I realize Lionel Bart was a complete genius, and Oliver was the top of his pyramid of genius. It's a great, great show. And we really kind of copied Oliver. We didn't copy it intentionally. Well, not completely intentionally. But it was very much influenced, and the storyline was Our storyline wasn't very good because it was essentially rather boring about a jolly nice chap who founded some homes. And Oliver, of course, is one of the great, great stories of all time. But it was set in London in the 19th century. There was the aristocracy against the low life. There were prostitutes with hearts of gold. There was a love thing. Our musical was okay, but it was totally unoriginal, and it was never going to get anywhere. But we were young, and Desmond Elliott, to his great credit, encouraged us enormously and said, don't worry, lads, this is going to be the hit of Broadway in 67. And we signed a contract with a friend of his who was a theater producer, allegedly. And we got 100 quid each advance, which seemed like a fortune. And the clause 7B said, on the opening night in New York, you'll be staying in a first-class hotel, and it was wonderful. And of course, nothing, I'm afraid, ever actually happened. But while we were waiting to become stars, overnight stars on Broadway, a schoolmaster, a friend of Andrew's, had heard the songs from the likes of us, which only existed on a demo record. We made a demo album of it, which demonstrated the songs. And he said, well, this is, you know, while you're waiting, because it's obviously going to be a few weeks or so before you go to Broadway, why don't you write something for my kids' end-of-term school concert? This was now middle of 67, the summer of love, which, frankly, we both missed out on considerably. And in late 67, we sat down to write something for Alan Doggett's school kids. And they were, and our cast was a collection of children from the age boys from about 8 to 13. And the audience, potential audience, was a rather reluctant group of parents, mainly mums, for a Friday afternoon performance, one performance only. And the only carrot we had was that if it goes down well, Alan said, an educational publisher might take it up and it could be published for other schools to do. So we had that sort of lure of the faint chance of writing a minor hit textbook. But, you know, we hadn't got anything else to do except wait for fame. And I was, of course, working at EMI and Andrew was being a student. Anyway, we sat down to write something, and because we had complete freedom, we didn't have to follow rules, which we rather foolishly followed too closely with the likes of us. We said, right, we've just got to entertain the kids. It's got to be fun for them. And we thought about doing a James Bond type story. We were given a complete carte blanche. We could write on anything we wanted, the subject matter. And we thought about James Bond, and then we said, no, James Bond will be forgotten in 10 years' time. We want something that's going to last. And we want something that will appeal to teachers as much as the kids. And this really brought it down to history, appropriately for where we are today, or the Bible. And my favorite Bible story was, and indeed still is, I guess, was Joseph and his coat of many colors. So I said, let's have a go at this story of Joseph, because we can make it funny. And Andrew wrote some wonderful tunes. And because there was no feeling of this, almost that it didn't matter. It was like all we had to do was to entertain the kids. We were writing for a group of children and one or two teachers. And we'd wrote Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, is what it became. And about once a week, we would send off the next scene. And the kids loved it. They really got into it very quickly. And the funnier we made it, the more they liked it. So apart from one or two songs, the whole thing is a bit sort of, you know, flip. But I hope in a moderately subtle way at times. And I think from my point of view, the influence the influence of that great songwriter, lyricist, Michael Flanders, Flanders and Swan, you remember, you know, the Mud, Mud, Glorious Mud, and the London Double Decker something bus and all that wonderful stuff. I loved all that. And another guy called Paddy Roberts, and I liked Gilbert and Sullivan. And it was funny words that appealed to me, and I thought as a child, this would appeal to these children. And indeed it did. And I remember we sent them the Coat of Many Colors song, which ended red and yellow and green and brown and blue. That was all we sent them. But Alan said, I hope you don't mind, after we'd sent them the song. They loved the song, but there weren't enough colors. And we've got the kids, they've added some colors in. I said, oh, really? A bit worried. Is this early indication of people fiddling with my lyrics? the kids sang it for us in the classroom, and they added all these wonderful, huge long list of colors, and it clearly worked. I'm not sure I can remember them, that's the trouble, because I didn't write them, red and yellow and green and brown and blue and scarlet and ochre and peach and all that. And it really made the song into something fantastic, and all the children, they sang it beautifully. And about 3 or 4 years later, when Joseph became quite well known, it got a review in the Financial Times, of all things, saying, the genius of Tim Rice's lyrics is the list of colors, which was the one bit I didn't write. But I did not write a letter to the Financial Times complaining about their inaccuracy. Anyway, Joseph was written. It was only about 25 minutes long. And we took it to the headmaster, who said, yes, I think this might work. And on Friday, the 1st of March, 1968, it had its world premiere at Colwick Court School in Hammersmith. And the audience was about, I would say, 50 mums, very few dads, because in those days, hard to believe now, but dads used to go out to work. And mums didn't. And we had all these mums sitting there saying, right, the last four concerts were pretty ropey. This one better be better. And it went down an absolute storm. They loved it. The parents liked it. The kids loved it. And in fact, so much so, we did it again. We did it. It was, the entire show was encored. It was only 20 minutes long. And the headmaster said, this is the first time the concert's actually been appreciated by the parents, so there should be no escape for the dads. We're going to make sure they come, and we're going to do it again. Would it be all right? Would you like to perform it again in a week's time on Friday night? And we'll hire a bigger hall so we can get the dads in. And you can imagine all the scenes at home, you know, and the dads go, oh, no, you know. Friday night, and I've got a very important meeting. No, you're coming. And we rented the Westminster Central Hall, which is a very famous building, very near Westminster Abbey, and where Andrew's dad used to play the organ there, Dr. William Lloyd Webber, a very distinguished composer and classical artiste, played the organ superbly. And he agreed not only to do an opening act for us by playing the organ, but he actually managed to get us the Westminster Central Hall at a pretty knockdown rate. And Andrew and I had about 10 days before this, and we'd added a few songs. We thought, well, Joseph's going quite well. It's only 20 minutes. Maybe we should expand it. So we put in a couple more songs, and we performed it. Billy Lloyd Webber did his bit on the organ, and then we came out, and we got the entire school in it, you know, even younger kids, not just the ones who could sing. And it went down beautifully. We dished out the lyrics so people could follow it. And it was entirely an oratorio then. It was virtually no solo numbers. There was an Elvis song, which I actually did at the time, because I was cheap. And a couple of songs, Any Dream Will Do and Close Every Door, were solos for individuals. But basically, it was an entirely sung by everybody, which was why it worked, because the whole school took part. And we thought, Alan Doggett said, well, I'm sure I couldn't get the educational publishers to come to the school, but I'm sure they'll come to this. And of course, they didn't. And we rather, you know, it went down wonderfully well with an audience probably about this size. But no response. And we were a bit downcast by this. But that was the Friday. In the Sunday Times, 2 days later, I was working, as I said before, for Norrie Paramore, and his big star act was The Great Cliff. He was a great star then and great star now. And incidentally, one of the nicest guys you could ever hope to meet. And Cliff was on at the Talk of the Town, which was a big cabaret venue in London at the time, now rather downmarket, the Hippodrome. And Cliff was doing a different sort of act. It was slightly more sophisticated than his rock stuff. And I'd been to see it with Norrie on the Tuesday and Wednesday, and he was recording it, and it was terrific. And Norrie was very concerned. He wanted this, you know, to get good reviews and to push Cliff even higher up the charts, if that was possible. And so I was looking in the Sunday Times that next day to see what sort of review Cliff got, if indeed he got a review. I opened the Sunday Times, column by Derek Jewell, who was an extremely respected music critic, and the first thing I saw was my own lyrics. I thought, hang on. And then followed a column raving about Joseph, about a school concert, saying this is magnificent work, these two young lads should be looked out for, blah, blah. And at the bottom, there was a paragraph saying, Cliff Richard opened this week at the Talk of the Town. As usual, very good. And that was about it. And I thought, oh God, Norrie's going to be livid. You know, I've upstaged his number one star. And it was a great review. And we thought, why did he review it? Well, we discovered that his son was at the school. We had no idea about this. And he hadn't been to the school concert, but he came along to the one at the Central Hall. And then, surprise, surprise, having got this rave review, Norrie Paramore said, well, I'd quite like to record this work. And we got an educational publisher, Novello, saying, we'd like to publish this work. And it taught me a lesson that most people, and I'm not knocking either Norrie, who hadn't actually heard it at that point, either Norrie or publishers in general, but most people only know something's good when somebody else tells them it's good, which is a rule very helpful to remember as you stagger through life in almost any area, I believe. But it was recorded. We made an album with it, and it was published as a book. And all the time, we were still thinking maybe we're going to get to Broadway with our Barnardo show. But we never did. And we were obviously thought Joseph had some sort of future, but it hadn't made as much money. It was being played in a few schools. It got nice reviews in the educational books and everything. But I thought, well, I'm going to really have to get myself, you know, push my job and work up the EMI chain. And Norrie offered me a rise. And we had one more performance of Joseph that we were doing at St. Paul's Cathedral. This was 1969 by now. And we had a big performance in St. Paul's Cathedral. It was part of a festival called Pop Into St. Paul's, one of the features of which was the Dean of St. Paul's parachuting off the dome. The late Dean of St. Paul's. And Joseph was performed, and it went down incredibly well yet again. And this time, there was a chap who heard it called David Land, who was in the audience, and he was an agent, a manager. And he had a management company, which was backed by a property gentleman called Sefton Myers. And Sefton, David was a very successful man in his own right, but on this particular venture, Sefton put up the ackers and David found the acts. And in fact, Sefton had been taken for a few rides with acts that hadn't really done much but spent his money. And he brought David Land in to find some acts that perhaps would work. He was a property guy, very successful, but he loved show business. And David knew show business. And David came up to us and we gave him the album. And he came back the next day and said, this is great, will you come and meet me in Sefton? And he made us an offer of, I think it was 1,500 quid a year each. And we had 3 years of this and we had to write something, whatever we wrote in that period, they would promote, they'd take 25% of anything we made, which at that point was not a lot. 3 years of management. He would give us an office, and it sounded terrific. And indeed it was. But I was a bit nervous because I thought, I've been at this lark with Andrew, who I believe is incredibly talented, but we haven't actually made any money. We've been at it for 3 or 4 years. I've got a good job offer from EMI. And I was dithering. I thought, oh, I don't know what to do. I'm, you know, 22, I'm over the hill. I've got to be very careful. And Andrew, of course, who hadn't at that point had to get a job and was much more confident about our success than I was, or our potential, he was saying, come on, what's the matter? You know, this is a great deal, we should do this. And while I did that, they put it up to 2,000 a year each. And I was still a bit hesitant because Norrie was saying, well, I think, you know, you should really work, you know, you can, I'm sure Cliff will record one of your songs in due course, which in the end he did, but it was absolutely, that was quite a long late, you know, quite a long time later. And I to cut a long story short, too late, I hear you cry, I dithered and dithered. And in the end, we got up to 2,500 a year each, going up in the following year to 3,000 and then 3,500, which in those days was a pretty good deal. And in the end, I took the plunge, and it was an awful day having to tell Norrie Paramore I wanted to leave, but he wished me luck. And we signed up with David Land and Sefton Myers. And they took over Joseph and said, well, we'll start promoting this one, but meantime, you've got to do something else, lads. You know, what are you going to do? And having got to know the Dean of St. Paul's, who's called Martin Sullivan, a delightful Kiwi, he was very intrigued by the Bible being put to music and lyrics that were instantly accessible to people of all ages. And he said, well, you know, you could maybe try perhaps other Bible stories. And I, ever since I went to Lancing in Sussex, which was about as high church as you can get without quite being Catholic, and I'd also been to a very religious school in Japan where my father was posted overseas for a year. I was always fascinated by the characters of Judas Iscariot and Pontius Pilate, who I thought, in a way, were rather unlucky to have been around at that time. And Pontius Pilate, some of the quotes he's got are absolutely magnificent philosophical questions. And Judas, who is perhaps the most, well, he's a key figure in the entire Christian religion. I mean, without Judas Iscariot, you know, Christianity might not have happened. Not that that was his motive, obviously. But I thought, and yet Judas in the Gospels barely says a word. He's just a sort of 100% figure of evil. And we are not really meant to identify with Judas, or at least we're not encouraged to, because however sinful or imperfect we may be, we couldn't be as bad as this Judas Iscariot who turned in our Lord. So I was always fascinated from a not really a believer's point of view at all, but by Judas and Pilate. And I thought one day I thought this when I was about 16. It'd be wonderful to write the story from their point of view. And here was the opportunity. We had financial security for 2 or 3 years, and we said to David, we're going to do a piece on Jesus, last 7 days of his life, based on Judas Iscariot. And he said, oh, I'm a good Jewish boy. Do you have to do this? We said, yes. But David, to his great credit, he said, I'll do the business. You do what you want. And we wrote what became Jesus Christ Superstar. And we were writing for the theater, which is what we always wanted to do, even though our first theatrical, I mean, we really had written off Bernardo. It's clearly not going to happen. And we'd left Desmond Elliott, and we were now with David Land. And the theater was where we pitched Jesus Christ Superstar. And it was originally just called Jesus Christ, which was, you know, strange title. Jesus Christ Superstar was an extraordinary title at the time. And when we'd more or less written it, David, as he'd said he would, took it to several to all the Cameron Macintoshes of the day. It was Lou Grade, Bernard Delfont, I can't remember all the others, but he took it to all the top theater producers, and they all said, no, we're not, you know, it's a bit dodgy subject. Anyway, religion is not commercial. No one's interested in this sort of thing these days. Sorry, but, you know, get them to do something safer like Robin Hood or something. But we were convinced that it could work, and David had the bright idea of trying it with a record company. He said, well, you know, you made a nice record of Joseph. Why don't you do it on record? And if the record works, if we can get a deal, then that might in turn lead to a show. So we went round to a few record companies, even EMI, my old outfit. And again, not much interest, except from one company, MCA. MCA, Music Corporation of America. Now, they're a massive organization in America. But in England, they just started up their own little label, because it was still the era of the four big labels. But one or two American companies were now trying to break into the English market under their own name. And MCA was run by a guy called Brian Brolly. And Brian loved the idea. He said, this is very interesting. Why don't you make a single, a pop single? Which we hadn't really considered, because we saw it maybe arrogantly as a theater piece. Something which wasn't really written as a string of hit singles. It was a piece that was, you either like the whole thing or none of it. But we had to do that. It was all we could. And Brian said, if the single's a hit, you can do an album. If the album's a hit, MCA will do concerts. If the concerts are a hit, MCA can do theater. If the theater's a hit, MCA can do a film. So we signed on a dotted line, the rights for the lot, never thinking we'd get beyond the single. And it ended up being a film. And we went into the studio, MCA paying, and we thought, what can we record? There was a nice ballad called I Don't Know How to Love Him, but we thought, well, that's a difficult one to get away, you know, a sort of rather serious romantic ballad, and who would sing it, and it doesn't tell you much about the show. So we went for the actual title song, Superstar, which was much more rocky and rhythmic. And Murray Head was a friend of mine, he still is. Murray was a singer at EMI who I'd met and who'd done a couple of singles at EMI which hadn't worked. And he was dropped, I think, wrongly. But I kept in touch with Murray. He was a great singer. And I said, Andrew and I have got this rather daft idea for a show which is going to be a record, just doing a demo record sort of. Would you sing it? And he said, fine. And he said, would you like a friends of mine to play the backing track? And this was Joe Cocker's Grease Band, who were a really heavy, brilliant rock band. And of course, that's partly why Superstar became quite original. The fact that it was a show, the first show really, to be a theater piece based on rock. I'm not for 1 minute, you know, talking, I mean, Hair was brilliant, but Hair and Tommy of The Who was being done about the same time, but neither of them were really telling a story, and Hair didn't use an orchestra. We were kind of trying to combine. And we didn't really know we were trying to do this. We were trying to combine the old traditions of musical theater with rock. And we only did rock because it was on record. Had Bernard Delfont said, yes, lads, this is a great idea. We'll put it on in Plymouth for 3 weeks and see how it goes. Well, we would have, with great respect to the musicians of Plymouth circa 1968, I don't think they would have quite got the feel we wanted. And we would have had an orchestra of 10 or 12 people, and it would have played for 2 or 3 weeks. And we also had the idea that it had to have a book, i.e. chat between the numbers, which would have it would have been a disaster. We were dead lucky, hence the word mistake, that we were forced in a way to make it as a record. And that became seen later as a stroke of marketing genius, coming out with a show score without the show. And we made the single, Murray Head. And we got a wonderful choir called the Trinidad Singers, who came from Notting Hill. And we got a load of great session singers as well, backing them up. And we made this single. And it was good. It was a good single. And Brian Brolly said, this is the best single we've had since we started MCA up, admittedly only a few months ago, but it was still something nice to say. And it was put out with a fair amount of publicity, but got banned by Radio 1 because of the word Jesus Christ. And I briefly forgot to say that originally the song was just Jesus Christ, who are you, what do you sacrifice? But there was a big ad for Tom Jones in the Melody Maker, which said, Tom Jones, the world's number one superstar. And I thought, Jesus Christ superstar, yeah. And that, I think, was also helped because it was a great title and shocking in a not unpleasant way back in 1969. Anyway, the single, just called Superstar, came out. A lot of fanfare, no radio play. And we thought, well, back to the drawing board. Maybe we should do Robin Hood. And then we got a call from Brian. It got to number 39 in England and then dropped off the charts. And it hadn't done that well. And we hadn't sold enough in England to justify the expense of an album. And then we had a call from Brian saying, you're number 3 in Holland. Really? And you're number 2 in Brazil. And number 1 in Australia. Good Australia. And the single was taking off all around the world, whether they just didn't understand the record, but the sheer tune and the rhythm was, and of course everybody knew the words, Jesus Christ Superstar. And the best of all, it got onto the American charts and tottered up to about number 40, which is not bad. And worldwide sales of this single, had they all been in England, would certainly have been a top 5 hit record. But Brian said, the Americans say you can go ahead and do the album. And we then spent the next year and a half with David Land encouraging us, and we made the album. And thanks to the rock feel we got of the record, we got a lot of great rockers in to do the album, like Ian Gillan of Deep Purple. And we were unknown people, but people liked the single. People in the business had heard it. And we got a lot of Mike Darbo, who happened to be a very good friend of mine through cricket. Mike Darbo of Manfred Mann did the King Herod song. And again, at the end of the King Herod song, he ad-libbed, Jesus, you know, it's one about the swimming pool and all that. And then at the end he says, Jesus, get out of my life. And there was a long article when it came out in America. The album was reviewed in the New York Times or something, saying, this brilliant album is summed up by the one line, get out of my life. That's what we're all saying to Jesus. We shouldn't be saying this. And again, it was not a line I wrote. And Mike Darbo has not asked me for a royalty, but when we play cricket, he can bat and bowl wherever he wants. Anyway, Superstar came out, and to a certain extent, the story was the same. The album was almost overnight a hit in America. That was what turned our lives around, and that was the big breakthrough for us. It went to number one with brilliant MCA promotion over there. They even didn't like our cover. They did everything superbly. And when Andrew and I arrived in New York for the first time, it was terribly exciting. And we thought we'd be told to get on the bus and go to a crappy hotel. We were met by limo and PR men saying, we've got the front cover of Time magazine, we got this, that, and the other. It was extraordinary. It was like another world. And of course, in those days, late 1970, what happened in America often took a while to get over to England. And nobody really realized in England how well we were doing. We did, but it was a mega hit in the States and in many other countries without doing too much in England. So when we came, I'm rushing through because I think I'm going to leave possibly a little while for a question or two. When it came to our next show, which I had this bonkers idea of a show about Eva Peron, we decided to go the route deliberately because it had worked so well with the record, which in Superstar's case did lead to a stage show on Broadway, did lead to a film eventually and shows around the world. We did the same with Evita. This time, weirdly, the record was number one in England and didn't do a thing in the States. It did eventually when the show came over there. But we had, by mistake, created a new way of promoting shows, put the score out there first. And if you write the score, that's the most important thing. Although important thing to us, although I've learnt often the hard way that the most important thing for any show, any play, any film, is the story. You can do well with a great story and an average score. You cannot always do well with a great score and a rotten story. You've got to get the story right, and the story is always what comes first. Now, there's a clock down here which says I've got 19 minutes remaining, and so after that, I did things like chess with Bjorn and Benny of ABBA, and I was very lucky when I was not quite sure what to do next. I got involved with the Disney organization, who signed me up for writing movies or animated films, which I loved since I was a kid. And the best thing I did for Disney was to recommend Elton John to write the music. And it was great, great fun working with him. So I've been very lucky to work with some great composers, not only Bjorn and Benny and Andrew and Elton, but I worked with Alan Menken, who's one of the great Broadway composers. And I have been dead lucky, and a lot of it's been an accident. So that's really how I got today. So I don't always give people who write to me this long a response. But I do say, to sum up, I cannot say the way to make it in theatre is to go to a book publisher with a bad idea for a book, because that's how I got going, by sheer chance. So I will now call a halt, and if any of you have any questions about anything Argentine foreign policy between the wars, you know, Judas Iscariot, you know, Lion King, what does Hakuna Matata mean, you know, what's Elton, you know, I'm open for any questions. So thank you very much for so far.
Well, that's it for today, but there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.